the nation station, Manx Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Roger Watterson, and this is Sunday Opinion. On Thursday next, at 8 in the morning, all the polling stations for the 2016 general election will open throughout the island, closing 12 hours later at 8 in the evening. Then the complicated task of counting the votes to see who are the winners and who are the losers. The conduct of the election is the responsibility of the 12 returning officers, one for each of the constituencies. In the second part of Sunday Opinion today, we'll take a close look at the work, duties and responsibilities of these returning officers with the assistance of Advocate John Wright. In the first part, we shall find out what part the captains of the parish can play in the election process with the captain of the parish of Santon, Donald Gelling. Before that, we'll take a look at the constituencies themselves. This is the first election with the new constituencies of the altered boundaries, and in some cases, names. Also, three-seat and once one-seat constituencies are a thing of the past, and all 12 of them are now two-seat, and the number of voters in each is approximately the same. There was a public view that the old historic arrangement was unfair and that changes should be made to create equality of representation. The Boundary Review Committee sat between 2011 and 13, and during that time presented three reports to Tynwald. The final report was approved by Tynwald to come into effect after the House of Keys had been dissolved and for this forthcoming election. The chair of the committee was Advocate Sally Bolton, and Catherine Nicol met her earlier in the week, and they started their conversation when she asked why the committee was appointed.
Well, I believe that Tynwald was, and certain members of Tynwald particularly, were concerned that there were discrepancies between both the size of constituency and the numbers of representatives that different constituencies had. So, for example, you had three members in Rushen or three in Onchan, and one in Peel, one in Middle, and particularly those areas had grown considerably in population size since the boundaries were last drawn, which I think was back in the 1950s.
Now, at the time that you were appointed, there were comments from some about overhauling the House of Keys, changing the number of members, whether we needed as many MHKs as 24. But your remit was actually quite limited. It was quite precise. What was the exact remit of the committee?
Well, the remit was set out in a resolution of Tynwald, which was to review the boundaries of the constituencies of Tynwald and report back to Tynwald with our recommendations. There wasn't, and it was quite clear in our remit, that there wasn't a review of the number of MHKs. That wasn't included in our remit, and neither was it to look at more fundamental changes that were perhaps put about in relation to changing the constitution generally, and including things like whether we should have legislative council or any other of those sort of aspects. Those were outside our remit, and we kept it to a fairly narrow line, although we did receive representations from quite a lot of people with their general views on that those type of matters.
Now, it was essentially in three stages. There were three reports from the Boundary Review Committee. You approached it in quite a methodical way, sort of broke it down into something that was seemed to be quite manageable, logical steps, if you like.
Yes, the first report that we produced, which was I think in December 2011, was to ask Tynwald to approve a recommendation that each of the constituencies should have equal number of representatives and that they should be of an equivalent size in their numbers of population that the members would be representing.
To what degree was it a numbers game? To what extent were, I suppose, existing boundaries of local authorities or sheadings taken into account when you were looking at redrawing the boundaries?
Well, that was one of our considerations, but in taking evidence and considering the principles that were approved by Tynwald, in order to achieve the principle of equality, which I think was the overriding principle, we had to look at the numbers first, and then we took into account what we called communities to try to make as little disruption as possible in dividing up the various constituencies to take into account the equivalency principle, as in having an equivalent number of electors and population.
Now, you came forward with recommendations for 12 two-seat constituencies, which would be a change from the number of one-seat, two-seat and three seats that we had previously. Why was 12 two-seat constituencies seen as the preferred option?
Well, actually, we went through all the possible combinations, ranging from one 24-seat constituency to 24 one-seat constituencies, and we looked at all the possible combinations in between. If people would like to remind themselves, the reports that we wrote are still online on the Cabinet Office website. And actually what we said was we don't really mind which it is. It's probably more likely to be acceptable and least disruptive for 12 two-seat constituencies to be put in place. And that was what Tynwald approved, probably for the same reasons.
You admitted throughout the process that any changes were not going to please everyone. To what degree did you engage with the public?
Well, we had, in fact, the Cabinet Office report shows, the final report shows an appendix with the amount of consultation that we undertook. But basically, we had public meetings in all four corners of the island to start off with. We took written responses and discussions in person from members of the House of Keys, local authorities and the public, who all came and, if they wanted to, came and discussed their suggestions with us. And this was how we came to what we wrote in the first report. And then after the first report, we then had other consultation. We also had, which caused some controversy and comment in Tynwald, we engaged with the students at St Ninian's, politics students, A-level politics students at St Ninian's, and they did, in the time allowed, which wasn't very long, they did a very good Facebook survey, which we put in the second report, I think it was, to look at what would be the best combination. And then when the third report was put forward, we also had public consultation and the draft maps were put in all, I think, in every local authority office. We also invited further consultation from the public. And I spent quite a lot of time up here in Manx Radio, along with some of my colleagues, explaining what our thought processes were and inviting people to come along and give their opinions.
Did you find there was a general acceptance that the basis on which the committee were working, those sort of underlying principles of equality of representation and equivalency of the constituencies, was something that people wanted?
Well, that was the first principle that we worked on, because that was what people had told us at the beginning. And so on that basis, we worked forward. And because they told us almost overwhelmingly that, in fact, I think it was just about completely overwhelmingly, that equality was the principle that they thought was correct, and that each constituency should be of an equivalent size, that we used those principles to go forward to come up with our final recommendations.
And the boundaries are now firmly set. We know what the new constituencies are. If anybody isn't sure which constituency, how can people find out?
Well, I think that they should look at the government website, gov.im. In there, it shows all of the reports from the Boundary Review Committee, which shows the progress and the reasoning of how we came to our decisions. And it shows the consultation processes that we undertook. The process was quite lengthy and detailed, and I would have to say well-meaning. And I would urge people, if they have concerns or irritations about what has arisen on the ground from the Boundary Committee's review, then that they perhaps look at the reports and they may get a better understanding of why those changes have been made.
It must have been quite a complicated process, redrawing constituency maps. Mm. How did you approach that? Where did you start?
Well, we started with a very nice man from what was the Department of Local Government, who came in with some maps using the mapping process. And because they had spent quite some time overlaying the census information, in embedding that into the maps. If they moved a boundary, they would be able to show us what the effect of moving the boundary right or left or up or down would have on the population for that constituency. It was quite a good exercise. We were able to just move it around as we wished. And then he came back with some new maps when we made different changes so that we could actually see what it looked like. And in fact, from our point of view, it was quite straightforward. I don't think it was quite such an easy job for the planning department, but they did a very good, made a very good effort for us.
So in terms of the committee fulfilling its duty, if you like, getting to the end of it, were you surprised that this time round the Boundary Review Committee reports were accepted and it is coming in for this?
Well, I have to say, I feel we all felt very honoured, really, when we had reached the end of it, and we commented on that in our final report. And it is, I've had lots of people come up to me and say that they welcomed the report, whether they now, when they see it on the ground, whether they actually agree with it in practice is another matter. But I do think that the reports bring into place the structure and the points that the public and the MHKs at the time felt were important. And I do feel proud that we have been able to influence that and bring it in. I appreciate that there may be teething problems at the present time whilst people get used to it. But I think that it is really setting a platform for the democratic process for the future. And if it's not, then it can be changed at the next time there is a boundary review.
How often do you think these sort of reviews should be carried out?
Well, we recommended that they should be done every other Tynwald. And so I would expect that after the next Tynwald, another boundary committee will be set up and be looking at the position again.
Looking at all the work you did over a 2.5 year period, really. Ultimately, that means for every voter in the Isle of Man, they can now cast two votes.
Yes, that's the best thing, really, is that everybody is now able to cast two votes, whereas in the past, in some places, we only had one vote, and in other places, we had three votes. And I think it, the most important point that has been implemented for democracy is that we now all have the same number of votes.
That was the chair of the Boundary Review Committee, Sally Bolton, talking to Catherine Nicol about the reasons for the significant changes to the Keys constituencies and their boundaries that have come into force for this year's election. Now, with me in the studio, and he's here shortly to talk to us about the work of returning officers and all the organisation that goes into an election, is Advocate John Wright. But John, too, has had some experience of boundary committees. You were a member of the 2005 committee, I believe, John, and author of a report on in 2006 on electoral registration. How does this differ to what you suggested?
Well, that's right. I mean, the 2006 report was purely about electoral registration and some of the anomalies that arose at the 2006 general election. The previous boundary committee only had a very short time to come to its recommendations because it was appointed very late in the day, and Sally had the benefit of time. But we recommended, well, we said that if we were allowed to continue, and we only presented an interim report, we never got to a final report, we were looking at either two or three seat constituencies, because we identified that the inequality of voting between some people having one and other people having three was important. And actually, that's not new. That was identified four boundary committees ago in the late 1970s, when recommendations were made for the boundaries of 12-2 or 8-3 seat constituencies. And when we were looking at them in 2005 and 2006, it was quite clear that if those boundaries had been implemented way back then, there would have been no need to change the geographical areas of the boundaries, because the larger your constituency, the less likely building a housing estate is to make it have grossly unequal numbers. And that was the other thing that we identified in 2005. There were constituencies which had a gross inequality of numbers, so that one MHK might be representing 1,500 people, whereas three MHKs might be representing 9,000 people. So if you look at how many MHKs per constituents per MHK, it was grossly out of kilter. But what went wrong with the ones in the late 1970s were that Instead, Victor Neal managed to persuade everybody that STV was the way round the problem, so that you only had one vote, but it could be transferred. And we went down that road for two elections instead. So that, I don't think there's anything wrong with STV. I'm just, it just sort of diverted from the two or three seat equalisations.
Right. Well, thank you, John. We'll hope you join us later on after the break. But now, let's have a look at a very different aspect of our election process, discharged by the captains of the parishes, and in some cases by a mayor or officer of a local authority, that of requisition meetings. The origins of the captain of the parishes can be traced back to Viking days, and it's the beginnings of the Manx defence system, watch and word, and that was established between the 11th and 13th centuries. Organising and calling out what became known as the militia was the captain's duty, and the militia were continuously active around about 1788, when there were extra watches maintained to prevent unauthorised landings at the time when the plague was spreading in nearby England. And there were 4,181 men mustered for the last time during the Irish Rebellion. Well, the duties of the captain of the parish have gradually disappeared or been replaced, but two have remained constant: the attendance at the hill on Tynwald Day and the calling of requisition meetings, a uniquely Manx activity. A candidate can always call his own meetings, but in this election there have been numerous requisition meetings throughout the island, and they still seem popular. So how are these meetings called? What's the value of them? And do they sort the men from the boys politically? Well, on the line now, from Deepest Santon, is former Chief Minister Donald Gelling. Good afternoon, Donald. You're captain of the parish of Santon, are you not?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm still in the morning. Right. I haven't had my lunch yet.
Well, that's the Manx way, isn't it? Right. Yes. Well, captain of the parish these days is, apart from those two functions that I've just mentioned, do you have any other things you have to do?
Not really. And, of course, I think you summed it up there very, very correctly, in as much as you said they were disappearing, or somewhat the duties of a captain. And, of course, that's what I have noticed recently, and particularly in this election, is that having to call, in other words, 12 people come along with a written requisition for the captain to call a meeting. And, of course, that appears now to have, with the boundary changes, caused some concern to people, because other meetings are being called. They're being called by, well, such as yourself, having an Any Questions meeting down in Ballasalla for the candidates who are invited to attend, to answer those questions. And, of course, the process now of the captain only holding a meeting if he is required to do so, and of course by law he would be required to do so, seems to be slowly sliding away, because checking around the island I find that in fact you've got, as you said again, the chairman of the commissioners maybe will invite the members to come along. They needn't attend if they don't want to, the members who are standing for the election. But, of course, it would be in their interest to do so. But I think you're right in as much as slowly but surely calling out the militia has gone. I think the requisition meeting calling is slowly sliding away as well, because the papers used to be full of captains saying that a certain number of people have now called for a meeting, and that they were listed in the paper, those persons that had called for the meeting, and where it was and when it was and so on. And that seems now to be slowly moving away, and some people don't like the change because they're a little confused now as to what, why and how. And I think the boundary changes have caused a problem amongst people who, well, if you take Santon, we're now talking about Santon. We were with Maloo, so Maloo and Santon. And, of course, it was a more rural area, and you had representation for that area. Well, of course, now Santon appears back into Middle, where years ago Onchan was in Middle, and they put their three members in. And that was it, because that was where the power of the vote was. When Santon went into Maloo, it was, in my opinion probably only, that was a more fair situation. Now, of course, you've got Maloo and Arbury in with Castletown, And I would suggest, again, the situation there is slightly different again, because the power of the vote will be in the villages rather than the surrounding country area. But the captain, I think the captain's duty of calling a requisition meeting, certainly, as you suggested, has slowly moved away.
But it's still there, isn't it?
Yes.
Indeed, it has been exercised a few times in this election. I think quite a few, in fact, when you look at them. Well, I suppose you'd be hard-pushed to find somebody in Santon with his own musket these days, but what about 10 or 12 people who might want to grill their candidates? It is sometimes a good way to sort the men from the boys, isn't it?
Well, exactly. But the strange thing is, do you know, I have not had one single person in Santon who has approached me and said, are we having a meeting or can we call a meeting? And of course, I find that, like Charles Varga, he informed me when the meeting was in Moraun School. And of course, I know there was another one in the Memorial Hall in Union Mills. And I know a few, and I say a few, have gone from Santon to those meetings because, of course, the candidates were there and they could be asking the questions the same as anybody else. But it just seems strange how that has moved, that it just worries me a little that people are a little bit complacent, and I am concerned about how the attendance at the polling station will be next Thursday.
Well, do you think this has got something to do with change in media as well? You mentioned that you hear candidates on the radio and their television items with them and all sorts of other meetings that are at. And, of course, we've now got the new three dimensions of websites, Facebook and Twitter. Do you think this has made any difference?
Absolutely. I think absolutely. Because, you know, let's go back a few years, and the only time you would have seen the candidates would be at a requisition meeting. And, of course, the place would be packed. People would be outside standing because that was where they could perhaps find out and sort out the men from the boys. Now you are told, go onto the website or Facebook. Now, you see, there's a lot of people who are still not into that, but that is the way it's going. And, of course, change will happen. And no doubt it will slowly but surely work that way, that everybody will be on some website, computers, Facebook or whatever. But at the moment, we're in that transition period where some feel that they've just been left out a little.
Do you think, though, in this modern day society, these performances on a stage with a relatively limited audience compared to, for instance, the radio, do you think it's a good way to assess a candidate?
Not always, because I must admit I've been listening to your programs of interviews and not requisition meetings, but your meetings, and actually they don't always come over the same on the radio at a meeting as, for argument's sake, their answers in the papers. And I've been interested in seeing how they change from one place to another, and they don't all perform the same. Some feel a little bit... probably it's not scared would be the word, but a little bit apprehensive about being questioned. And you don't always get the true, probably, feeling of that person. But at the end of the day, it is one way you have to do it, because that is the modern way to do it, is by radio and by interviews, and not by actually physically seeing these people.
I don't suppose you can still, though, beat pressing the flesh, can you? You know, the knocking on the door, it's something which, of course, in other countries, the canvassing's done by the party agent. But
absolutely.
Over here, I don't know how well that goes down.
Yeah, well, of course, now we're in this new system. Concern is that I listened to what you said before about it being unfair. Some people could vote for three and some would be only voting for one. Well, we're still in a situation where you've got two votes, but plumping is still there. And, of course, there will be some movement around, I would have thought, by candidates of saying, well, of course, I know you'll vote for Joe Bloggs, but give me your second vote. And we've seen this happen before.
Oh, yeah.
The second vote will take them in.
Yes, in fact, I've seen second votes go up to the top of the poll in some constituencies. Yes. Well, Donald, thank you for joining us and taking time to join us this morning. I'm sorry that Santon didn't have one of your jamborees, but one or two of the others did still manage to do it.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We were talking there to former Chief Minister and the Captain of the Parish of Santon, Donald Gelling, CBE, about the historic Manx activity of requisition meetings. Well, it's time for a break. When we come back, we'll be taking a look at the work of returning officers in conducting the forthcoming election with Advocate John Wright.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.
You're listening to Sunday Opinion. Now, with 62 candidates knocking on doors, holding meetings, appearing on the radio and TV, publishing manifestos and putting up their posters, the attention is naturally on them. But behind all of this is a well and long-tested system of administration, both from the Cabinet Office now and by 12 returning officers, one for each constituency. So how are they appointed? Who are they? What do they do? How do they do it? What powers do they have? How are the votes counted? There's so many questions, and the man who knows the answers to all of them and many more is Advocate and former Returning Officer John Wright, and he's with me today. Well, John, yes, it's the task of a Returning Officer, I should imagine, is not quite as easy as I almost made it sound then.
It's one of the most intricate and enjoyable but hard tasks I've ever done in my professional career. You've got to remember, I suppose, in the Isle of Man that we didn't have returning officers until 1866 because, of course, there weren't elections until then. And when they started off, they had six three-seat constituencies, the six sheadings, and then they had single-seat constituencies for Castletown, Peel and Ramsey, and then the rest of the seats were Douglas. And there weren't enough advocates in the 1860s to do all the elections on one day, so the elections were staggered and advocates took on more than one constituency. But in all the time I was doing it, from being a poll clerk when I came back from university through to being deputy returning officer and then returning officer, and I think I've been returning officer in more constituencies than anyone else. I think I've covered five constituencies in my time. It's always been on the same day, and there's always been a bit of a race to be the first one to get it out. But I mean, the first thing you do is you get all the paperwork, you get the electoral registers, you put up the advertisements that say when nominations are going to be taken. And historically, when I was doing it, nominations were for 2 hours on one day. Of course, this year we had the new lengthened period for nominations because people were complaining that they couldn't manage to get themselves sorted out to turn up in a named place. Struck me as silly because you didn't actually need to go yourself. You just needed to have someone go and hand in the appropriate form. And of course, as soon as you've got the forms in, you know who your candidates are and you've checked them and the time for withdrawal's gone. There's then notices of polls. You have to order the printing of the ballot papers and things like that. And you administer, not the proxy votes, but you administer the absent votes and are now advanced voting. And that's where I started. The very first time I did poll clerk, I was just qualified as an advocate, and I went round as very junior advocate, sorting out what were then sick votes or absent votes. And we used to go to the people's houses and we used to produce the ballot paper, and someone would mark it, we put it back in the envelope, and then we handed it back to the returning officer. And when I was doing that, we also had a team of people, so like quite often we'd get the captain of the parish. So I remember going to Dick Gorn down at in Russian, and he would go around the house. He used to, my dad loved going round the houses, talking to people and gathering their votes. And we've gone back more to that because the last few elections, they've been posted out rather than someone going around personally. And that, there was a perception, especially after the Douglas East problem, that maybe things weren't as tight and as foolproof as they ought to be. And of course, with proxy voting, there's been a tightening up with having to produce identification to register and vote as a proxy.
Well, indeed, because of course all that spun out of the last election, didn't it, and issues that came about. But tell me, when we go back to the start, you talked about advocates, even going back to the 1800s, advocates taking on the job, so that the qualifications of this. Local authority elections, the returning officers, all sorts of people in that instance, very often the clerk, the town clerk.
Indeed.
So what is the more for the keys? Is it it a job that requires more legal knowledge? Or
I don't think so. I'll tell you what I think it was. The local authorities in the 1860s were very small and virtually non-existent, especially for the rural sheedings. And it was a question of, you have to provide your own staff. So what you had was, you had advocates with clerks who were literate and could deal with that. And I think it's just a hangover from that.
Mm. But who appoints you?
We're appointed by the governor through cabinet office. And normally what happens is, when there's a vacancy, there's a memo goes round from the Law Society saying, we've been told by cabinet office that there's a vacancy. Does anyone wish to apply?
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you put a badge, you get polling papers printed, you do all the other stuff like this. Now, where do the funds come from to do that?
We get paid. At the end of the election, we put in a bill which covers all the cost of everything that we've done. Mm-hmm. And that goes, obviously, through Cabinet Office to Treasury.
Right.
And one hopes that one doesn't have to pay out of pocket. So if you get a bill from a printing shop for something, you hope that you can stagger payments until you've had the refund from Treasury.
I see. Right. Well, OK, there's a hint there that perhaps it takes its time. Yes.
They're pretty good with things like that, yes.
Yeah. Now, when you say arrange the polling stations, we often have people grumble when the polling station changes, or I've heard returning officers say, well, I couldn't get that place because the nursery school's in it today. I mean, how difficult is it to get the right places at the right plot, especially with the change in borders?
It can be difficult because clearly a lot of the places we use have other uses, and there are fixed schedules for nursery classes or for badminton or whatever else. And it's not just a disruption on the day itself, because things like the polling booths and the ballot boxes are delivered several days in advance sometimes by government. And obviously on the night, although you clear up as much as you can, it may be that things aren't taken away the next day in any event.
Mm.
And obviously, if you requisition a school as your polling station, you disrupt the kids' education for a school day and things like that. So it can be problematic, but generally people cooperate and try and do it. But as populations change, where you had a polling station previously may no longer be suitable, or it may go. I mean, the first time I did any work in a polling station was out in the green corrugated hut in Sandton, miles from anywhere. But that stopped being a polling station, I think, now, because I think you only got through four or five people in a day or something. And you know, you look at some of the other constituencies, as housing estates, especially on the edge of Douglas or Peel, have grown. What used to be central is no longer central, so you end up with people having to travel further, and they grumble, or it's lots of people now, instead of walking, they use their car, so you need somewhere that's convenient for car parking and things like that. And quite often, it might be convenient to use one building and have two polling stations. So if you've got two polling districts, but they're close to each other, somewhere on the boundary, there are economies in staffing and things like that, because one of the things I found, and one of the reasons I stopped doing it, was that, first of all, I'd have had at least one of my staff, if not two, working on the election full-time for nearly a month. On the day itself, I had to give all my staff, apart from a skeleton staff, a day's holiday, and then they got paid for going out and being poll clerks and counting clerks and presiding officers. And then the day after, there's a huge sweep-up task of boxing everything up, identifying it, cross-referencing and checking.
What happens to all those? When the poll is all finished and you've done all that and all the bundles and everything you've done is all packaged up, where do they go? They go into store then?
They go to the High Court, and they're kept by the General Registry for a limited period. And the reason that they're there for a limited period is that if there is an election petition, the court can order that the bundles and boxes are undone and things are looked at. If there's an allegation that there's been personation, in other words, someone's voted as someone else, then the court, in appropriate circumstances, can order that the ballot papers be looked at. And it's possible at that stage to backtrack and see.
So when the boxes, when during the day, you say you have your officers there, your members of your staff who are making sure that all's played fair. And then when it's all over and the boxes are sealed in the polling stations and brought back to where you're doing the count, from that moment onwards, then, there's, as you say, there's quite a lot of effort. But the permutations with three, it would be even worse, but the permutations maybe with eight candidates, people, two votes each, and two candidates, it's quite a complicated bit of maths, Liz.
It isn't the maths. The maths is simple. It's the practicalities of how you do it. Think back to when we had one, two and three seat constituencies. If it's a one seat constituency, it's really easy. You just put the ballot papers in piles for each of the candidates. If it's a two or a three seat constituency, the way that I used to do it in any event was, first of all, you separated out the ones which only had one vote on them, and you could put those in piles. That's easy. Then you looked at the ones that had two or three votes on them, and those you had to transfer the votes onto analysis sheets. So you had sheets which had the name of the candidate, all the names of the candidates, and then columns and vertical lines, and you added up the number of votes that turned up for each candidate.
And do you still use the bulldog clips to keep all the papers together?
Do you know, I haven't done this now for 10 years. I'm not sure, but they're actually quite useful because it's easy to sort of do them in 10s or 25s or 50s. It
helps with a recount, I would imagine.
Well, indeed. And that was one of the things that I never understood, why there was the objection or the suggestion that the STV vote was difficult, because you declared a result at each stage. And if no one challenged that, you never, ever went back beyond the last stage you got a clear result for.
Now, at the polling station itself, we always hear about issues with people who are tellers interfering with people coming in, or disabled voters having a problem, or all sorts of things. Who at the station rules on issues arising?
Well, first of all, the presiding officer, that's the senior member of staff there for the day. And if they have a problem, obviously in this day and age, we've got mobile phones, and it would be the deputy returning officer or the returning officer. When I was deputy returning officer for a very big constituency, Russian, many years ago, what we used to do, I and the returning officer, who in those days was Peter Neal and was very dapper, and he wore his morning suit and he had a bowler hat and all that sort of thing, we drove round from polling station to polling station, and we covered each of the six polling stations every hour, let's say. So it meant that we were, one of us was there for a few minutes every half hour. We did a and yes, there are some problems getting people in. One year we used Port St Mary Town Hall and someone turns up in a wheelchair. Well, there are 15 steps up to Port St Mary Town Hall. It's not got a lift. It's not disabled accessible. It doesn't comply with the Equality Act or anything like that. The one which always gave me greatest...
What did you do then? Did you bring the paper out to them?
Technically, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to get two burly men to lift up. But in fact, in that one, we took the ballot box outside. It was easier, and it was the other one which I always used to get great pleasure from doing was if someone turned up to vote who was visually impaired, you throw everybody out of the polling station, and just either the senior poll clerk, the presiding officer, or the returning officer would then read out the names of the candidates, ask who they wanted to vote for, and mark the ballot paper. Of course, that's demeaning. It's taking away the blind person's independence. And now, for this election, at the very first time, they've got a sort of template.
Oh, sort of braille marker.
So that it can be done without taking away that independence. And that's a good move forward.
Well, there must be unused papers.
Yes.
Well, what happens to those?
Well, what happens is you have a... First of all, for each polling station, you have the ballot boxes. You have an electoral register, so when someone turns up and wants to vote, you mark them off on the electoral register as having turned up and voted. Only questions you're allowed to put, are you so-and-so shown on the electoral register with this number? They don't need the poll card. It's easier if they take it along. It makes finding where they are on the electoral register easier. There are then all the ballot papers, which have to be stamped with a mark. They are issued... and then they're put in the ballot box. The ones to left at the end of the day are counted and put in a sealed envelope. And then the ones that are in the ballot box when they get to the counting station are also counted. And obviously there should be an equality of
the
numbers
stubs,
with the stubs and with the unused ones, because you know what you started off with.
Yeah.
So there are several checks in the process that allow you to... And there are sometimes people who come along... Let's say someone has done impersonations. Someone's voted...
Does that happen?
To Roger, I've never had it happen in one of mine, but say that someone turns up, says they're Roger Watterson, my polling clerk doesn't know, they issue him the ballot paper, he marks... Then Roger Watterson turns up.
Says,
we have what are called tendered ballot papers. They're pink ones. And those then identify them as being a second vote by Roger Watterson. Mm. In that case, it would probably be reported to the police. The court could order the release, and you could check. And if it turned out that it wasn't Roger Watterson who'd exercised the first vote in Roger Watterson's name, it can be identified. Means the ballot papers can be extracted, they can be taken from the result, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. So right at the end, when all the counting is done and the result is out and all the people's blood pressure is starting to come down again, which is very stressful under the count, for those watching anyway.
It's stressful for all the parties.
What do you do? They're told who is the successful and who are not.
Yeah.
Then you issue them with a writ.
That's right.
And now what do they do with that?
They take that the next day up to Tynwald, and that's their warrant for then being sworn in at the next sitting.
Now, all of this process, which is, as I said, historic and fairly well-proven system, actually, it's been going a long time. There's a lot of pressure now in some countries, and I think it's building here, for online voting. What do you make of that?
Well, if you go and have a look at my report from 2006 on electoral registration, first of all, I recommended that you should be able to register online and that you should be able to individually register, and I don't see, as long as there are appropriate safeguards built in, why you shouldn't be able to vote online or electronically as well. I mean, in America they've had voting machines for a large number of years, and you'll probably remember the hanging chads debate for, was it some of the machines weren't working properly one election about 15 years ago, and it what happens is the machines they were using in some states punched a hole in the ballot paper, and some of them the paper didn't actually get
properly
punched out,
right.
And they were called hanging chads, and there was a debate as to what the interpretation was of those votes.
Yes. But it's this idea of voting online, there is an argument backing that if that was permissible, the turnouts would be better.
It's certainly one argument. One of the basic things, and it's still a problem. One of the reasons I was asked to report in 2006 about electoral registration was that electoral registration was down to less than 80% of the census population. So if you looked at, and it was constituency biased. So East Douglas might have only been 65% of the expected population registered for vote. A rural constituency might be 90%. And I certainly suggested that we should be looking at getting 95% of people registered. It's what they aim for in Northern Ireland. And it would, at the moment, we're about 82-83%, I think, as an average. Mm-hmm. So that means that 17% of the population have been disenfranchised.
But sometimes intentionally, I've spoken to people who come from other countries, I think it's nothing to do with them.
Well, if they're entitled to vote... Mm. They should be. And of course, this then comes on to, should registration, which is technically compulsory, should that be enforced? And secondly, should there be compulsory voting?
Well, that's another complete debate, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. Now, let's say, John, I didn't ask you, are you staying with us to the battle line?
I'm more than happy to, stay on for the...
Well, that's fine, because there we must end now. And in this Sunday Opinion this week, we took a look at just three of the very different aspects in the forthcoming House of Keys general election process, with the chair of the Boundary Review Committee, Sally Bolton, captain of the parish of Santon, Donald Gelling, CBE, and former returning officer, John Wright. The Man in Line, Manx Radio's Sunday phone-in programme, will be open for business at 1:15 after the news, weather and sports, so telephone us on 66 13 68. You can text to 166 177, or email to studio@manxradio.com. Catherine Nicholl was our producer, and I'm Roger Watterson.